Welcome to the MedTech Talk Podcast. This is your host, Jeff Pardo, and for this month's episode, I'm thrilled to have Dr. Aaron Kaplan of Dartmouth-Hitchcock Medical Center. Aaron is a man of many talents and hats: interventional cardiologist, inventor, entrepreneur, teacher, mentor, and a tremendous influencer within our MedTech ecosystem. We're going to discuss many things today, including Aaron's baptism into medicine and entrepreneurship, his latest venture, Conformal, his work in founding the 3D Symposium, which brings together many of the stakeholders in our industry, and we'll discuss much more. Aaron, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Jeff. It's a real pleasure and honor to be here.
You and I have known each other for many years now, but actually, I don't think I've ever asked you how you got into medicine first and then subsequently entrepreneurship and innovation. So tell us a little bit about your background, and was medicine your first love or interest, or what was it?
Well, thanks for the question. And I'll start by disclosing the fact that my father was a psychoanalyst. So when you ask questions like that, you can always get very involuted answers. But I grew up in a medical family. My dad, as I said, psychiatrist and psychoanalyst. And my mom, interestingly enough, was a industrial designer. I think had she been brought up in another era, would have been an architect, and had a thriving interior design business when she passed when I was in medical school. So I've always had this kind of duality, and started my undergraduate career at Tufts as an engineer. And they had a BSES program, which was Bachelor of Science in Engineering Science, that gave you a professional degree, pretty rigorous, but required you to have a natural science degree and also to fulfill all the requirements that a natural science degree would have for a liberal arts degree. And that was biology. So it was a very good degree for me. And I actually left undergrad thinking I wanted to do research in basic science, very interested in the tools that generated new technology. I was quite fascinated by fluorescent activated cell sorters, and that got me into actually hematology, and spent a year down at Cornell in New York, working on the extension of my thesis I did at Tufts, which is in the hematology department. But very soon, the kind of draw of clinical medicine drew me in, and went to medical school. And my engineering really got reunited when I went to Stanford for my cardiology fellowship, which I was able to get that fellowship based on my research. And I was doing my research at the time, and I went to Stanford to do a transplant. But after spending time in the cath lab, this was just eye-opening for me. And that my research work was really in the platelet world, because clot formation is a lot about what cardiology is about, and it's a lot of the time of what interventional was bad. At that time, you may recall, this was in the early 90s. We were figuring out how to put stents in, and clotting of stents was just, the Achilles heel. And I was doing basic work. I would take arteries anywhere I could find them, primarily pig carotids in the neck, and put them in baths and perfuse them with human blood, primarily from me, with labeled platelets, and then look at the impact of angioplasty on those arteries in very defined areas, and antiplatelet agents. And it became very clear to me that we were treating the whole body to be able to anticoagulate just the artery, and which led me to my first startup, which was to have something called, LocalMed. And we infused the artery with heparin to have local anticoagulation, while we pulled out all of our equipment. In those days, we were using large bore catheters to deliver stents, and I was doing holds for 3 and 4 hours. So I brought this idea to John Simpson and Tom Fogarty, who are just, giants in the field. And Simpson who's had a tremendous influence on me, said, you know, Aaron, I am thinking about the exact same problem, but I want to do it by figuring out how to put a suture, single suture closure at the site of the arteriotomy site. And that was Perclose. Hmm. And this got me into some hot water, but fast forward, I was able to be on the founding team of Perclose. And with John, obviously, was the big driver there. And I was kind of the driver founder along with John Simpson and Tom Fogarty of LocalMed. And this gave me kind of a ringside seat primarily to watch Perclose, and was just transformative for me. And that's how I got my baptism.
Yeah, amazing. And you're with some of the real, I think, as you mentioned, some of the real giants in our business in terms of innovation. What were some of the things that you learned from the likes of Simpson and Fogarty?
The amazing thing in Simpson, who I don't know if you spent time with him, very, you know, he's a Texan. And, you know, at those time, he was focused on DCA, which was DVI at the time. DCA is atherectomy. And it was a shaving device to put in the coronary, technically very difficult, larger bores. And when he and his team, and I was a fellow on these teams, would do a beautiful atherectomy of the LAD only to cause a groin problem, we would go to the operating room and the surgeons would do an incision. This is a vertical incision in those days, probably about 4 or 5 inches. And they would divide the inguinal ligament and they would get the artery all exposed to put in one stitch. And Simpson would say, they do all that for one stitch. And he says, if we can figure out how to do put an angioplasty balloon at the end of 100 centimeters or an atherectomy device, we should be able to figure out how to put one stitch in. And the important insight was that he said, and you can use the whole aorta. You have the Perclose device must be 30, 40 centimeters, and it goes up the aorta. And there's a lot of engineering and mechanism in that. And you're pulling the stitch through. And his articulating that was one stitch, use the aorta, and building a team around that. And it was a fundamental lesson for me about the role of the doc. And the role of the doc is not to the design device, but to define the problem. And you may have some basic concepts, design constructs, but your job is not to design the product. Your job is to define the problem and make sure the solution can work within a very narrow and demanding clinical kind of needs window.
That is really interesting. And I guess as you go through it, I mean, that it seems easy in concept, but I imagine difficult in practice, right? As you get into these ventures or you see other clinicians in these ventures, do you see them often sort of getting out of that box, and does it cause problems?
Yeah, I think, you know, there's actually a real dichotomy, and it's something I really think about and work on. My role here at Dartmouth as a senior attending, teaching fellows and kind of helping guide the cath lab team, is a very different role than my role at Conformal, which is my current entrepreneurial focus. In the cath lab, you know, there's only one attending. Socratic, and I want feedback. But at the end of the day, I really have the bird's eye view, and I'm teaching my fellows. It's a craft, and I actually know more than they do. I've been doing this 30 plus years. They're very gifted, but I'm teaching them my craft. I want feedback, but at the end of the day, I'm driving the process, also we look at failure very differently there. We're always, you know, talking about what ifs to avoid failure and really to keep them in the very narrow lanes. That's different than my role at Conformal, where my job is really to be much more collaborative. Conformal is a startup I founded with Andy Levine, who actually was a buddy who I knew back at Tufts, was a real engineer a year ahead of me. And my role there, which I modeled after Simpson and Fogarty, was defining the problem. And the problem there is left atrial appendage closure, which is a revolutionary new approach to addressing stroke risk in AFib patients, and which has really been pioneered by Boston Scientific with the Watchman device, where you they've developed a plug that's placed in the left atrial appendage, is where clot forms in AFib, so you don't have to give these patients blood thinner. And my role at Conformo was to help define the problem, to be able to have a device that's easier to place, that doesn't need ultrasound guidance. That's we have a two size fits all. Boston has five, and we'll soon have six sizes for theirs. Our device doesn't require the same precision. All this to transist the conformal procedure from a procedure now, which requires an anesthesiologist, an echocardiographer, and an implanter, which is even a structural cardiologist or an electrophysiologist. And to transition from that with the patient under general anesthesia to one doctor via one stick doing the procedure without the need for general anesthesia and continuous ice or ultrasound. And it was defining that problem. And my initial solution was to use foam, and had idea of using some of these sponges that, you know, expand when you put them in water. I mean, how naive was that? But it defined the problem. And Andy and Dave Melanson and other members of the team who are real engineers were able to grab that concept and turn it into a real device. And it's been just a terrific journey to date.
It's so interesting because I often, tell me if you think this is wrong, but I often think that in medicine, training in medicine, you're not really trained to say, I don't know. Whereas in the startup world, you do have to say, I don't know, or admit where you're kind of the bounds of your knowledge, where the bounds are, and then go out and find the answer or find people who know the answer, who can assist in getting the answer. And I wonder how difficult a transition that is from, as you say, the medicine and the cath lab, where ultimately you are looked to have the answer, versus being in a startup where, you know, you often the answer is not there, and it is that process of exploration.
Yeah, it's a process of exploration, and also learning how to collaborate. Because in the cath lab, you know, at the end of the day, I'm the one who has to talk to a family after a complication. I'm the responsible one. And if I say, hey, I decided to use this dosing of drug and it's wrong, and I get that from a fellow or a nurse and it's wrong, it's my, you know, I can never say to the, well, I asked, you know, the fellow, and he told me that the dose was, you know, and it was wrong. It's my decision. I'm the captain of the ship. Totally different than in the startup world, where there are a lot more unknowns. And not only that, my medical college says, Aaron, why aren't you an engineer? And my mom was still around. She would tell you I actually graduated with honors. Why don't you go and design that? And it misses the point, because if Andy and his team, if I'm teaching about engineering, guess what? I need a new team. They better know more than me, and I better be comfortable with that, and comfortable with the fact that their solutions are going to be better than mine. And it's not really about it's building a team that's focused on the solution, and getting a really multidisciplinary team that has competencies that are, you know, very much divorced from the medical world. And the other thing is, and it's learning how to fail. Which is really not part of the paradigm in the cath lab.
Yeah. Interesting. Now, one of the things I know you're very into is music, and you were a musician yourself. And I'm curious, what impact did that have in kind of your creativity or just your career in general? Does that open up different ways of looking at things for you?
It's funny, I see a lot of parallels between my musical training in high school. I was a very serious young French horn player, which I'm sure everyone wanted to be. But I grew up in the suburbs of New York, and was really privileged to study French horn with a very famous French horn player who actually was the first horn player in the NBC Symphony under Toscanini. It was at the Manhattan Conservatory. It was terrific and helped kept me out of trouble, quite frankly, in high school. And there was a lot of learnings from that that are helpful in medicine, less so in the startup. In medicine, well, first of all, you're studying under somebody, and that there's a very, you know, and there's a lot of a discipline in terms of getting it right and repetition and ensemble. And that's very, I pull on that a lot in the cath lab, you know, trying to get the perfect angiogram, the perfect picture, and do it each time. And kind of, you know, it's a variation on a pretty narrow theme. And the discipline of doing that and to just really push it to get to as close to perfection as you can, which I think is important in the cath lab, less so in the startup world where it's much more, I guess, jazz and freelance than it would be kind of classical.
Interesting. And I'm curious, you know, just your creative process as a as an inventor, tell, you know, as you think about Locomed and Triton, which we'll touch on, or Conformal, what were those processes like? Were these kind of epiphanies in the cath lab as you're doing these procedures, or what has been your creative process across these different startups?
You make it sound like it's well thought out. I think it's more that, to me, part of me is an inventor, and it's in my daily walk as a doc, I'm confronted by problems, and I'm thinking about them, and I'm thinking about, you know, Conformal. I actually took another approach about 20 years ago with the idea of using a snare device, which I ended up abandoning. Other people have used that approach. But I'm thinking about it. And yeah, as opposed to some people, they have a new technology, have a new nitinol. How can I use this? I'm more like, oh, here's a problem. And boy, I've thought about five or six different approaches to closing the appendage. But and then, you know, with coming up with this foam base, that was enough for me to really think that we had that something that would be both proprietary, but also fundamentally better. So I'm always thinking about it. And then when I have an idea, you know, people at Conformal, similarly at Triton, I guess I'm easy to make fun of me, but I do a lot of kind of conceptual sketching now in a PowerPoint where I conceptualize what the procedure will look like. And I do some conceptual design that often violates one, if not two, of Newton's laws, but really to help define the problem. So I get these ideas and then really try through that kind of schematic design, help me articulate it for real engineers to kind of maybe laugh at or gawk at, but to really define the problem.
And I want to get into some of the, you know, beyond Conformal, some of the other experiences. But one thing I've always been curious about, you're in kind of the epicenter, one of the epicenters of innovation, being in the Bay Area and at Stanford, and you make the transition to Hanover, you know, quaint Hanover, New Hampshire, which is beautiful, but not Menlo Park or, you know, Silicon Valley. So what made you make that decision? And yeah, tell us about that.
It was actually turned out to be a very good decision. And I've had Dartmouth has been a good place for me, but there are real trade-offs. There are a couple of things. My approach has always been to be fundamentally a clinician who was working to solve problems that I was confronted with in my clinical work. And in order to do that, you need a platform to do your clinical work. When I was in the Bay Area, I was attending at the VA in Palo Alto, which is a tremendous institution, but was recruited out to Dartmouth. And initially, like, are you kidding? You know, it's like I grew up in New York. It was like that New Yorker Steinberg view of the world that, you know, there's New York and then there's the Hudson River and then there's, you know, San Francisco. And the view of the only thing good can come out of the world comes from New York. But there's a similar feeling in the Bay Area. And it is a very unusual place, which you realize more once you leave it. But for me, I was able to take a lot of my learnings from there. And there is kind of a groupthink there, and the negative aspect of that and getting away from that was actually in certain ways positive. And I think Conformal is demonstrating that. So in the Bay Area in the last 10 years, everyone was so focused on valves, looking at all the mitral programs that came out of there and renal denervation. And I'm seeing things slightly different. So there's a plus about not being in that whirlwind. The negatives are that there isn't a critical mass of talent to pool on. And I've done two startups since I'm leaving. And their structure, one Triton was very different. I did that with Rich Davis, who's a very gifted engineer, and with Spray, and that's how we met with Dan Cole. And we were able to really iterate because it was with stents, which was pretty mature at the time, and could do our early iteration with Richard in Florida. And myself, and we almost had we had calls almost every morning at 5 o'clock to really able to keep the design process going. And that would only be doable for a Triton, which had which was a stent technology, as you recall, for bifurcations. And that to iterate stents at that time, because the technology had been so well worked out with laser milling the stock tubing, that we could really iterate very quickly and efficiently. We would not have been able to do that with other technologies. For Conformal, which is more classic startup, it really required me to work with Andy Levine, who is a clearly of similar vintage to me. Actually, he's a year older because he was a year ahead of me, but he's been a serial entrepreneur in the Boston area, and as from all that work, has a very deep network of engineers from which he pulled on and really to build a team. So the move from the Bay Area was positive in terms that I could kind of get my own market reads and not be kind of pulled into the, you know, where every the kind of deals everyone's chasing. The negative was that the infrastructure to pull together teams is a lot, it's a much different dynamic and really required me to partner, which actually is a good thing for me to have to do with someone like Andy, who could pull in on that critical mass that does reside in the Boston area.
And one of the other things you do, which I think is so great up at Dartmouth, is you really sort of spur entrepreneurship on amongst your the clinical community. I would imagine in the Bay Area, you know, people, the clinicians are, there's probably a lot of very savvy clinicians with respect to, you know, getting something into a patent and, you know, getting something going, and you have the money right around, as you say, kind of the infrastructure. But at Dartmouth, you've really played a key role in terms of getting that thinking infused into some of the clinicians up there. Can you talk a little bit about that and kind of what
Yeah. Well, I'm not sure how effective I've been, but there is a different thought. I read this thing once that in Southern California, a reporter went down the street and just asked people, you know, pitch me your idea for the next sitcom or whatever. And like 30% of them had something to pitch. I think there's something similar on the Stanford campus that you go to a fellow or a junior faculty, say, hey, what startup are you doing? And they're all thinking that way. And it is a way of thought. And part of it has to do with the infrastructure that I referred to. There are a lot of venture firms there that can help, you know, nurture that process. And commercializing something there is seen as a real positive. Dartmouth, there is an entrepreneurial environment, but it doesn't have that critical mass. An example is that what Stanford is very much known is the biodesign program that really pioneered by Paul Yock, Josh Machauer, and phenomenal work that they've done, and they build teams. You know, people, we thought about trying to do something like that here at Dartmouth, not really replicable. But, you know, our kind of variation on that theme was a program that I was that I actually developed was an entrepreneurial fellowship, which allowed for faculty with a good idea to get a protected day a week to, you know, figure out whether that idea made sense. And with the idea at the end of the year, they would come back and talk about the, you know, their new speculum, like, you know, why it failed or what were the next steps to towards success. And coming out of that, there's a company here, Cairn Surgical, which is doing some very innovative work that's goal is to eliminate false margins for a resection of non-palpable breast tumors, which is the majority of them. Rick Barth, who's one of the senior surgeons here, had been working with the engineers over at Thayer and had some insights on how to use MRI imaging to really build a 3D model that looks almost like a bra that to guide needle localization to do it more accurately and in the operating room. To use that to have more precise resection. But that process that Rick and the other co-founders of Cairn did is the same process, but it was done more in the context of something like Dartmouth that didn't have the ability to bring in a huge team like they can do at BioDesign. And which I actually think is actually more reflective of the real world, which is can be defined as the world outside of the Stanford campus.
Right, right. Is there, and now that you're really mentoring, playing the role of mentoring many of these clinicians and efforts, are there certain themes that you kind of hammer on early on as they're thinking through their, you know, their idea? Or mistakes that you can see, you know, which are kind of common across people who haven't necessarily been on the business side of things like you have?
Yes, I think if you've heard them. The first is that, you know, what is your role as a doc? And that's to define the problem. And then to build a team to help, you know, work a solution. And that's fun. And the other one is that it's about the mission. Working with Dan Cole very early on, that it actually took me a while to figure out when he once said, you know, Aaron, you're thinking like a real cardiologist. It took me a little while to figure out that it actually wasn't a compliment. and that, you know, as a leader of a startup, it is about the project, and it's about finding the solution. And the other thing is learning, you know, to, you know, come up with different, you know, solutions, and to pick holes in them and not be afraid to fail. But the real take home message for docs are your job is to find the problem and then work with people equally as skilled as you to figure out, one, is this really a problem that is, you know, can command the capital, the resources, need capital to go after? So, you know, what is the size of the market? That's the business side. The clinical side is how big is the clinical need? And so it's hard for docs. They say, oh, Aaron, I want to work on this. There's this through a section of this, you know, kind of tumor that, you know, I vaguely remember from medical school that happens, you know, 1% of the time. And it's not a big enough market, and it's very disappointing for a clinician. But on the other hand, it's how resources actually probably should be applied to the bigger problems. So, you know, letting the doc know what their role should be, because most docs feel like they need to be, okay, we need to find a leader. Okay, I'll be the quarterback here. It doesn't quite work that way. And then to very rigorously figure out, you know, how big of a problem, i.e. market, this is, and can that, then all the usual, is it proprietary? Can you really do it? Can you show that what you have done makes a difference and a big enough difference for anyone to change their behavior? So it's a real process, but the fundamental process is having the docs who understand that what they really need to help do is to define the problem.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And I also remember being on the receiving end of some of those. There weren't really compliments that Dan would always have for you. Constructive criticism. So, and he had a colorful way of expressing it.
But I actually, I have a lot of admiration for Dan. And for people who don't know, Dan was one of the founding partners at Spray. And before that was the president of SciMed, really championed the interventional arm when SciMed, after SciMed had been acquired by Boston. And he is a hard driving former naval aviator from somewhere in the Midwest. And he was really the first person I partnered with Triton. And, no one ever confused the two of us. We're just such different backgrounds. But it takes that kind of, collaboration. Dan, who, is just a manager's who can, I always think that, he can smell BS 5 miles away and have a very colorful way of identifying it. But that kind of difference is what you have to really enjoy working with. And because a recipe for failure, and I see this in the students, my best buddy, we're engineers together. We have the exact same background. We want to establish a company together and do a startup. I'm like, you have the exact same skill set. You have the exact same expertise. That's not the way you go around think about building a team. And Dan was really helpful in my own development to understand that.
Yeah, I mean, he was a terrific mentor for me as well. And it's what you're saying makes so much sense to me because, we think a lot about in today's world, diversity. And we're thinking about it in terms of diversity of, gender, of race. Of course, those things, are helpful in creating, diversity in thought. But what you say makes a lot of sense. I mean, you coming from New York, a French horn player, and Dan coming from Kansas and a Navy fighter pilot. I mean, you guys were approaching things very differently, and yet that sort of diversity of thought is when it comes together, it can really produce interesting advancements.
And have a little bit of fun along the way.
Yeah, exactly. And that, Triton, so maybe we talk a little bit about Triton because, this was really, I think, an ingenious invention and something that worked clinically. I mean, thousands of cases, right? And yep. And you really refined it down to something that was very slick and was working, and yet it didn't really reach the outcome that we all hoped for. So what were, as you sort of reflect on Triton, what are some of the things you learned and what are some of the things that as you transitioned into Conformal, what are the lessons you brought into Conformal?
Yeah, no, I think there's some really important lessons because I do think that the engineering and Rich Davis deserves tremendous credit, as does the whole Triton team for that. But that, so for those who don't know, and there'll be a lot, and that's a hallmark of, as you said, what'd you say, that it didn't reach the, have the outcome we wanted. And that is startup speak for it failed. And because it failed, there's probably a lot of people who don't know about it. So Triton was the first actually dedicated coronary stent to be approved, and it was designed to address lesions in and around side branches, bifurcation lesions. And that the idea for Triton was that it would rebuild the bifurcation in situ. At the time, and you would place a side branch stent, and through that specialized stent, put a main horse workhorse stent in the main branch. And as I'm talking about, I'm getting excited again. And it was an elegant solution, but it failed for a couple of reasons. The first reason why it failed, and this is a huge learning for me, is that, and it's interesting, we were a touch late. That a year before, or there was a couple of companies that were acquired that never got to the clinic that were good outcomes for the venture investors, not a good outcome for the ecosystem, but for the venture investors. And that one learning is that you really want to be at the growth part. You want to be in a growth market. And these things, when I mean, I talk over at Tuck, I mean, that sounds like, you know, just pure basics. And it is that you really want to be in a market that's really growing and growing quickly. And it's a much more forgiving environment. I saw this at Perclose. Perclose had identified a market that really had potential, and that really allows you a lot more freedom. We came at this a touch late. So that was problem number one. Problem number two was, as we're doing this, there was a lot of confusion in the marketplace about the role of drug and for drug-eluting stents, and there was a thrombosis signal that was going on. So it was unclear to us about the role, but our strategy was, look, there's a lot of money, a lot of resources, a lot of really bright people who are building, figuring out the drug-eluting stents, you know, the polymer, the drug, how to put them on. And our job is to develop the backbone. And we've built the backbone. That's our, you know, proprietariness. And then we'll be able to, the logical outcome is that we'd be acquired by someone who can, who has one. And this would expand their market, and which was a good thesis. But the problems was that by the time when we got there, there are now, you know, and, you know, there are many drug polymer combinations work, but there's only three that really have been developed in the U.S. And that have the confidence of the marketplace. And so that really narrows your exit potential. And I think is something you have to be really careful about. The other thing to be open about, we our pivotal trial, which we decided to do with a bare metal stent, bare metal Triton used with a drug-eluting main branch stent, missed a portion of its primary endpoint, which is not a good business strategy. And though there's a lot of learnings of, you know, we ended up recruiting patients whose arteries were inappropriately small for the stent, but the comparator was balloon and it was well-sized there. And, you know, it took us a while to figure that out. And the learning there was two learnings. One is, there's first mover advantage, but there's first mover risk. This was the first trial of its proportions to look at something like this. And what we learned was that in retrospect, that we had recruited the wrong patients. The other thing, quite frankly, was don't run a big trial like that unless you have best technology. And the idea here is that we would show benefit with a bare metal stent, and then we'd be able to partner with someone to put drug on it. And then they would make it even better. There's so much risk to a trial that in retrospect, is, you know, we really should have worked the discipline to do it with a drug. And finding that partnership was difficult for us.
Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense. And something you and I have chatted a bit about is, and it's common with many startups which have to raise a lot of money over many series of stock, is maintaining that alignment amongst investors and making sure, yes, you know, when good you know, opportunities present, that people are motivated and everybody can be successful. And I don't know if you want to comment on that, but I think that
I actually not as much as maybe I should, but there are a couple of overarching things. As you get further down, you know, company's kind of critical mass shifts more to the financial side. And you have the financial folks running it, and it not only dilutes the founders, but you can have misalignment. And I think that, without going too much into detail, that there were options for exiting Triton, but that the most recent investors weren't totally aligned with the structure of that. And I think that it made sense to them at the time that they could, with a little bit more investment, get a bigger return. But by the time that was executed, the market really had moved. And I think that there was a couple of big learnings from Triton. One is, make sure you're working in a market that's growing. And it's more important to be in a growth market than being in a huge market. But if you can be a big market that's growing, that's really where you want to be. And number two, when you're building up your financiers, your syndicate, your backers, that's aligned to what your boards look like, and try to build a board that really complements, that's complementary, that really can help guide the company. And we had started that way with Triton. We had a very good board with Dan Cole, with Rick Anderson. But as we added additional folks, they weren't as close to the market, and they weren't as aligned. And that, I think, was a real problem for us.
And so transitioning to conformal, I imagine you'll be able to take many of these lessons and put them into play there.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, it's, you know, one is that, you know, we're in a market. I mean, LAA closure this year, which I think is the fifth year, is almost $1 billion. There aren't that many billion-dollar markets in medical devices. There's a lot of learnings that I've taken from Triton applied to what's going on at Conformal. The first is that the LAA closure market is a market that will be, if not exceeding this year, next year, $1 billion. And Boston has done a masterful job in developing this market, and did a real long pioneering effort. And there's real benefit in terms of being a, quote, fast follower, which in the context of medical devices still seems slow. But that is very important. But this aligns with the doc and me, because I can tell you the mission behind LAA closure of providing an alternative to chronic anticoagulation for patients with AFib is a huge problem. So the doc in me and the entrepreneur in me are, you know, aligned. Growing market, big problem, number one. Number two is the team being able to partner, I believe I did at Triton, but similarly with very gifted engineers. Andy Levine deserves tremendous credit, along with other members of the founding team. Dave Melanson, very talented engineer. Carol DeValian, Ron Lamport. I'm sure I'm missing someone. But, you know, and working with Andy to build the team, and then surrounding that team with very good backing. Our board, Scott Ward, who many people know, currently the CEO of CSI, many years at Medtronic, really, well, he tells me he brings adult supervision, but really brings a perspective of a very sophisticated operator and very helpful. Josh Phillips, at Catalyst Ventures, really provides a financial perspective. More recently, George Fazio, who's an outside board member, who's the CEO at Corvia, brings a perspective of a startup operator. And that kind of board, along with Andy and myself, is really balanced. And one of the real learnings from Triton is to have a board like that. It's small, everyone's focused and aligned. And that's really allowed us the, I think the good technology that's been developed, the market timing, the team allowed us to really command the ability to have a financing that was led by Fidelity a year ago, a very large financing that will allow us to fund a large pivotal trial, which we're getting ready to do.
Yeah, that's super exciting. And one of the things I wanted to ask you about, and then I want to talk a little bit about the 3D development symposium, which you've really founded and developed over the years. But before we get to that, one question I've always wondered is your thoughts on kind of the role of a physician board member. And, you know, the great thing from my perspective is you know, when you have someone, particularly as a founder in the technology, have, you know, tremendous insight into the problem, as you've talked about. But where it can run into problems is that person becomes kind of the voice for the clinic. And we all know there's a real diversity of perspective. So in your role as a board member for some of these companies, have you felt that tension? And how do you deal with it if it is a tension?
Well, I think it goes back to what I was saying before. My role as Aaron Kaplan, attending physician in the Dartmouth Cath Lab, is very different than my role as Aaron Kaplan, you know, entrepreneur, business perspective that I bring to the, and the clinical perspective I bring to a boardroom. And you have to be really mindful about that. And these are the learnings that I think was drummed into both of us by Dan Cole, my job on the board level is to provide a clinical perspective. And that really goes into clinical regulatory, clinical development, understanding of the technology, bringing a very deep understanding of that, but knowing that that is a necessary part of the equation, but it's not the only part of the equation, and that Conformal will not be successful unless that the business side, the financing of it, the engineering is done well. And that's the perspective you have to bring. And also understanding that Conformal is not being designed for the Dartmouth Cath Lab.
Yeah.
Because if I'm the only one doing it, there's not a big market there. And I have to be very mindful. And Conformal is interesting in that the implanters are interventionists as well as electrophysiologists, and to work really hard to understand the market. And it's not the market as defined by Aaron. It's the market. And it's so interesting to me that as I, in my walk, to see how things are done differently and to keep that perspective.
Yeah. So let's talk about 3D, because this is really one of, I think, the most important efforts underway because of your ability to have brought together really almost all the stakeholders in our industry and get them in a room and actually have them talk about things, and not only talk about things, but solve problems. So can you talk maybe about the origins of it and where
yeah. And this has been one of those things that really Dartmouth has allowed me to do that I don't think I could have pulled off at Stanford, ironically, but that was really reflects my having a foot of well planted in the clinic and a foot well planted in the startup world. And seeing, you know, I like, you know, people say, how do you deal with all those venture capitalists? They're so arrogant. I go, well, you know, I grew up dealing with world-class, you know, heart surgeons and interventionists. And, you know, we have arrogance too. And now I'm a full professor at an Ivy League institution. Boy, there's arrogance. But that arrogance that the clinicians have, doing, you know, high-risk intervention with Impella and all this other stuff. Boy, if I can do that, I can run a company. And that's lethal thought. And I see it all the time. And that the premise behind 3D really came out of conversations I had. And I think I want to give a shout out to Paul LaViolette, who was very helpful to me in doing this. But I was at a meeting and I just heard a very well-known academic lecturing FDA and industry of how drug-eluting stents should be developed. Totally amnesic the fact that, hey, you know, something, we may not be the smartest people. And that after that, I saw Paul LaViolette at the Boston Scientific booth, and we were interrupted by another interventionist who was going unnamed, who actually interrupted me, which I'm used to, but kind of said, hey, Paul, you know, this taxes thing, when you get back to the US, why don't you fly out and I'll carve out a couple hours to help you with that. And he left. I'm like, does that guy understand how tough it is to launch a product? And actually, the taxes launch is still being talked about, how effective it was. And the idea that it's not just the academics who have the insights, that the people in Conformal, the people at Boston Scientific, have a very sophisticated and a good understanding of AFib and the stroke risk. And the people at FDA, you know, the interventionists, we're not the only smart people in the world. They're very bright people thinking about this problem. And same thing in the venture world. And the whole premise of the 3D conference is to acknowledge that we're all actually good products, real markets are solving real clinical problems of magnitude. And there are a lot of different people from different perspectives looking at the same problem. And the premise of 3D is bringing these people together and to work really hard to have equal access to the podium and to keep it focused on narrowly on real problems. Early on, the first one was the day of the first one. And the other thing is when I moved out here, there are people who helped with recruitment, Marty Leon, instrumental. David Feigl, who was helped at CDRH, very close to Tom Fogarty, another one of my mentors. I was working with him. And they also, when I got out to Dartmouth, they would come up and give grand rounds, but I brought them all together at the same time. And as luck would have it, the very first 3D was on a Thursday, and the Wednesday before is when Feigl and also Bram Zuckerman was part of this, issued the first Dear Doctor letter that was highlighting to the possibility of a thrombosis signal with a Cypher stent. Mm-hmm. And we had Marty Leon, who was the PI, coming. Bram Zuckerman was there, and it was like, you know, showdown at the OK Corral. And it really ended up being a very, I think, good meeting to talk about that issue, which was fundamental. The other person who played a huge role was Don Bain. And that was, to me, to bring those people together and for me to have like a ringside seat to that. And I think some really good things came out of that. And that really set the tone. And it's been very kind of fortunate to continue to enjoy the support of those folks and the people who they respect to be able to bring together this kind of a unique group. And it's, and you know, it's really allowed me access to all sorts of folks and been a real, I believe has made a important contribution to add to how the dialogue goes on.
And, you know, it's, you know, our business at the root of it is just about the people, right? And it's the people in every aspect of it. And sometimes when we're dealing with FDA or dealing with CMS, you know, in these big bureaucratic and sometimes it seems obstinate entities, you forget that you're dealing with people. And the beauty of your conference is that you actually get to sit down to dinner with people from FDA, with people from CMS, and you get to have discussions. And I, over the years, I remember attending the early ones, and I don't know if you'd agree with this, but there was a real progression in their openness in at the 3D conference and their willingness to really engage and participate. And it's those relationships, I think, that ultimately make a huge difference.
Yeah, I do think there has been an evolution that, and I think the current leadership under Jeff Shern has, you know, enabled that. Our dialoguing with Tamara Sirk-Jensen at CMS has facilitated. But I think the fundamental learnings for me as a doc entrepreneur when I go to FDA, these are people who are, you know, actually, they're very concerned about AFib and stroke. And they really want to make sure that this is a huge problem that we're confronting and trying to address. And they are, though sometimes it doesn't always seem that way, but they're aligned at wanting to make sure that we get to the American public a good, robust alternative solution for those who can't take anticoagulation. And when you, I think, take that perspective, now they have a different perspective. There's no doubt. They don't have a board of directors. They are very serious about their role in promoting health and promoting and making sure it's done in a safe way. So different perspectives, but really looking at the same thing, which is the same thing as industry and docs, I think, miss that a lot, that the really good business leaders, they know that they don't have a really good business unless they are addressing an important need in a robust fashion.
Well, it's one of the great conferences that is out there. So I'd really encourage anybody that hasn't attended to make the trip up in the gorgeous autumn weather of Woodstock and Hanover and attend. Aaron, this has really been fantastic. It's great to get the chance to catch up and just hear about all the things you've learned and developed and are still putting out there really enjoyed it.
Well, thank you, Jeff. And I want to wish you a happy holiday and happy and healthy 2022.